Almighty and merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for the generations still to come. Amen. Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 20th of October, 2016. Confirmation of minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 24th, 29th, 30th of June, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 27th of July, 9th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th of September, and 7th of September, 2016.
Found the minutes was correct.
Communications from the chair.
In case you know what is the communication on the Chief Minister before the chair.
Mr. Speaker, can I rise just to congratulate the Honourable Gentleman Lady for the position having taken my seat this week, the announcement that he was made from the convent on Monday, a few years ago. So I've said already in a public statement my principal political opponent these days, and I can say one will not continue. To do the case, but at a professional level, he has been recognized with the award of the rank of Chief Counsel, and I want to, on behalf of all members in this country, congratulate him.
I associate myself with those remarks and congratulate the leader of the opposition on my own behalf and that of the staff here in Parliament, most richly deserves achievement in my view.
Thank you very much, to the speakers, and thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, for your congratulations. When the Honourable Chief Minister said about a week and a half ago that he respected me as a lawyer, but not as a politician, I still have a glimmer of hope that
Regulatory Authority for the year ended the 31st of March 2016.
order to life. The process committee answers to all questions. We begin today with
we proceed with answers. I have received notice from the Chief Minister who wishes to make a statement.
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I met with the Deputy to the Government for advising to appoint new ministerial portfolios under Section 46 of the Constitution and to issue particular directions to that effect. I want to start this afternoon, of course, by thanking all ministers for the work that they've each done in their departments to date. I've spoken to all ministers overnight and explained to them how it was that I proposed that the Government should now continue the discharge of its responsibilities and each of course. I'm delighted to hear that they will be moving to new departments and new challenges, whilst, of course, being saddened in the same way that they leave behind people who they've built very strong personal relationships with in the past 5 years. The work ministers have done in the departments that they have been responsible for since the 9th of December 2011, and then in the year building up to the general election last year, was magnificent work, and I want to thank them for it. It was, of course, that work which led to the magnificent and unprecedented growth in our support from 200 votes in 2011 to 5,000 votes in the general election of 2015 last year. We were supported by 7 out of 10 voters. As honourable members will recall, I announced that there would be a ministerial reshuffle after the general election by the time of the following budget. The small matter of the campaign and the referendum on exiting the European Union got in the way, and I am at the House today, but there are differences in the reshuffle that we will do today to the reshuffle that we would have done a year ago after the general election as a result of the Brexit referendum. So it is time now, almost a year after the general election, Mr. Speaker, to reshuffle, to refresh, and to reboot. We think that we have in the announcements that we made this morning a better calibration of the spread of departments in order to better align service delivery in areas where we've detected that we're doubling up on efforts where we are delivering a service coordination. As a result, when honourable members look at the subtle, they will see that the changes obviously have nothing to do with any individual's capacity to deliver in one department or not to deliver in another department. You see, Mr. Speaker, I have no doubt that I am probably the luckiest Chief Minister in the history of Gibraltar, and I know that I am in the presence of 2 others, in terms of the talent available to me and the undoubted ability of ministries to deliver in any department or ministry that I might ask them to deliver on. This is therefore, Mr. Speaker, the ministerial configuration with which I would have wanted to start the lifetime of this Parliament, with the additional changes that the Deputy Chief Minister and I have made as a result of the Brexit referendum. So I can start now with the work that I'm going to ask the Deputy Chief Minister to discharge on behalf of Her Majesty's Cabinet of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, those of us here and I have been working together now for well nigh 25 years, a quarter of a century in politics together, and as far as he looks, not a day older, Mr. Speaker. And this manifestation of a portfolio is one which we have agreed is the best way for him to assist me in the discharge of my obligations and for him to apply his extraordinary talent. Those who know Dr. Rashid as long as I do know that his abilities are without rival in the context of making the case to Gibraltar. He is no doubt, in my mind, Speaker, the best Deputy Chief Minister Gibraltar has ever had and is able to deputise for me in some instances to do a much better job than I would in terms of lobbying and ensuring that Gibraltar's message is put across. At this historic time in the affairs of Gibraltar, Deputy Rashid becomes the Minister for Exiting the European Union. He continues to have responsibility for lobbying internationally and for the representative offices abroad, and he continues to have responsibility for European affairs. And if I may say to Mr. Speaker, for Joseph Garcia and for Fabian Picardo, it is indeed with a heavy heart, a very heavy heart, that we create ministerial responsibility for leaving the European Union, something that I know all members in this House would not have wanted as the CF had to do. In the process of doing so, the Deputy Chief Minister will retain responsibility for land and government projects, for civil aviation, for information, and for political, democratic, and civic reform, as well as for the promotion of the rights of the nation and liaison with the United Nations. The speaker I follow now with the announcement of a major ministerial change, which relates to the work of John Cortez, who will become Gibraltar's new Minister for Education and will relinquish responsibility for that. In doing so, I think it is important to highlight that John Cortez is a magnificent political operator, although I think he prefers to think of himself as an environmentalist first and foremost. He has done a magnificent job, therefore, in health. He has brought transformational changes to the Gibraltar Health Authority, where we have repatriated many, many services, which means not just a lower cost to the health service, but also less stress for patients. They are now able to enjoy the benefits of caring for Gibraltar where previously they might have had to go abroad for the purposes of that place, who leaves it as the highest spending department in Gibraltar. But he leaves the post able to have the satisfaction of the huge number of soldiers that he has completed in the past year alone, and in the 5 years that he has been in post since December 2011. There are many other changes also already on foot in the DHK, some of them already very near to completion. But I'm going to ask him also now to retain responsibility for the environment and for the upper rock, which are the areas that all of more are second nature to him, as well as climate change. The maintenance, administration, and operation of tourist sites in these two would also come to him, which he's been better served in that department in the context of the Department of the Environment than in the context of the Department of Tourism, where we're looking instead to develop a department that promotes the goals of international. Minister Fitzgerald seems to retain responsibility for public health and environmental health, and the big change is that he's going to become the Minister for the second highest spending department in the government, which is education. Now, with education, I'm giving John a huge amount of responsibility, and I'm going to ask him to do something which has never been done before in the history of Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I'm asking John to just deliver 5 new schools during the lifetime of this Parliament. The planning of that work is already underway, but the beginning of the project is to start under his time as Minister for Education. He's also going to be responsible for delivering on our commitment to bring school lunches into school. He's therefore going to become Gibraltar's very own Jamie Oliver. In education, also, Mr. Speaker, John will have responsibility for the further development of the University of Gibraltar, one of the flagship projects that David Yehudi was the father of, and which now is ripe for further development under the tutelage of Professor Daniela Sulia, Vice Chancellor. I'm also asking John to take responsibility for heritage, which we think fits well with his responsibility for the environment, given that a lot of our heritage assets are in areas where he is going to be doing a lot of work also with the part of his portfolio that deals with urban renewal. And he will retain responsibility for the utilities, including refuse collection and disposal, which is going to fit well with the environmental portfolio that I'm asking him to keep responsibility for. In terms of heritage, Mr. Speaker, I remind members that there will soon be a new Heritage and Antiquities Act, and it will be his responsibility to see that act through Parliament. So, Mr. Speaker, in effect, he will be both our Jamie Oliver and our Indiana Jones, all rolled into one. Mr. Speaker, I can think of no one better to take on his own responsibilities. Mr. Speaker, Gilbert Yehudi will move from education, which is now the domain of John Cortez, to take responsibility for employment, for tourism, for natural aviation, and the port. And I should say, Mr. Speaker, it's very apposite that Mr. Yehudi is not with us here today, given that he's in Denmark, promoting Gibraltar in an international backgammon tournament where he plays for the Gibraltar side, already starting to do the work on Minister for Tourism. David Yehudi, Mr. Speaker, to all those who have the opportunity of working with him, they know he's an incredibly gifted politician and professional. He's a man who has delivered in the lifetime of the last Parliament and the early parts of this Parliament also, probably more than most ministers have delivered in all their time in the previous governments that they have been in Gibraltar. He's already delivered to 2 ministries. He's delivered a university and he's delivered a small boat marina already. I'm asking him, therefore, to apply his considerable ability to areas where we need to see a new possibility in a post-Brexit world. Tourism is just one of those responsibilities. I think it is an area where we can do things in a different way, and that is why the Department for Tourism, the Ministry of Tourism, that Gilbert Yehudi will lead, will not be responsible for the maintenance of the tourist sites in the beaches. It is going to be a department which I will now ask to look outwards to the rest of the world and not inwards to Gibraltar, in order to promote Gibraltar to the rest of the world and the tourist destination, with responsibility for keeping the sites in order, and in the order that they need to be, into the standard that they need to be passing the rest of the Ministry of the Environment. I'm also asking Gilbert Yehudi to head a Department of Commercial Aviation, which will include responsibility for Gibraltar Air Canada Limited and new commercial aviation projects, another area where we believe there are opportunities for Gibraltar after Brexit, and to take responsibility for all entry points to Gibraltar, including the port. I'm consolidating all responsibilities in respect of the port, which is previously split across ministries in one ministry for the port, to include maritime services and ship and net registration, another potential area of business for Gibraltar. And in respect of employment and social security, which will move together with the Industrial Tribunal to David Yehudi, he inherits from the request for the lowest level of unemployment in recorded history in Gibraltar, and his job will be to maintain those low levels of unemployment in the ballpark of where they are today. Something that Mr. Speaker, that Mr. Yehudi will be well acquainted with, if he was the cabin in which there was responsibility for employment in the time that I was leader of the opposition and before me under David Cameron. We believe we will retain responsibility for coordination and international exchange of information, civil contingency, the support of fire and rescue service, and the airport fire and rescue service. We can move on now to the responsibility of Albert Isler. Albert Isler will head a new ministry, the Ministry of Commerce. It is important, in my view, to consolidate in one, consolidate in one ministry what we do for the financial services industry, what we do for the gaming industry, and what we do for the e-commerce industry, and what we do in e-government, and therefore, he will also take responsibility for government IT, together with the responsibility for business and commercial affairs and for postal services. Albert Isler is a speaker with undoubtedly a very, very safe pair of hands. Members of the financial services and gaming communities know that they have in Albert Isler a minister who listens and who understands the issues of effective business integration. He is undoubtedly an excellent conciliator who has the capacity to deliver the most sensitive project. And as we move into this post-Brexit world, we need to ensure that what we do for commerce in Gibraltar, we do well and we do in a joined-up way, and hence the creation of this one ministry that will deal with the concerns of business in Gibraltar. I know that Albert will have a very big job in his hands to ensure that Gibraltar's financial services remain attractive for Brexit. He's already doing an excellent job of working with me and with the Deputy Prime Minister in recalibrating the nature of our relationship with the United Kingdom for Brexit to ensure that Gibraltar does remain very attractive to the financial services community. He has the depth of understanding of those industries to be able to assist us and to deliver for us and for those industries. Speaker, I move on now to two extraordinary talented young people who have done an excellent job in government since the 9th of December 2011. And I'm not going to start talking about Peter Farmer. Neil Costa has done a magnificent job in every ministry I've asked him to oversee. He will become the Minister for Health, Care and Justice. Health is not a new area for Neil, as he has shared responsibility for health in the opposition and the Peter Farmer and himself. And in creating this new Ministry of Health and Care, we have thought it important that we can celebrate the way that we deliver care across the board in our community. Until now, we have had a ministry dealing with health, a ministry dealing with elderly and mental services, and a department of social services in another for the disabled. So today, Mr. Speaker, we create the Ministry of Health and Care, a ministry that will deal with all the care services that we give in our community in one joined-up way. We will take on responsibility for the health authority, for elderly residential services, for social services, and for the disabled, all under one minister. We think it's time to stop doubling up the work that we're doing to keep efficiency in the way that we deliver these services, so that we get the best value for money and therefore have more to plow back into the provision of care that we give in our community. And this Ministry of Health and Care is one that I've been very keen indeed to create since the 26th of November last year, and I'm very happy that Neil Costa is going to be heading it. His record in each of the departments that I've asked him to lead on is one of delivery and one of efficiency, and it's absolutely right that he has the opportunity to now head this new pioneering Ministry of Health and Care. I sincerely believe that creating the Ministry of Health and Care is the most revolutionary aspect of what the government is doing today in this example, and it will be good for our community in the long term. One of the things I'm also asking Neil Costa to do is to take over where Gilbert Ricciardi has done a huge amount of work in the Ministry of Justice. Neil Costa becomes also today the Gibraltar's Minister for Justice and the youngest one ever to boot. He will take on responsibility for the legal system, for the probation service, for tribunals, for the community service team, for access to justice, legal aid and assistance, which we all know is an issue that needs to be resolved as soon as possible, and where Gilbert Ricciardi has done a huge amount of work already in the Bar Council and with the judiciary to find the right parameters. We need to also take on responsibility for law drafting. And so after today, Mr. Speaker, Neil Costa becomes Minister for Health, Care and Justice. In dealing with issues that relate to health and care, I am conscious that the issues that face the border are not just issues for our community. They are issues for all of Europe and for the United Kingdom in particular. Wherever health services are provided free at the point of delivery, there is a problem in all communities as our communities age, and we have to ensure that we are able to continue to provide the standard of care that we want to be provided across the board. It is also important to note that there is a huge interplay between care and justice, particularly in the areas of mental health and respect for some young people in care, and this ministry will be best equipped to deal with those issues under the auspices of one minister. Mr. Speaker, the other young talent that has done extraordinary work in the time that we have been working with in government has been from Mr. Speaker, I should turn all the hardships the matter of an injury was flying into Gibraltar today, but it found itself diverted not just in her ministry, but also to Malaga Airport instead of Gibraltar, and will join us as soon as we are able to get her into the jurisdiction. Mr. Speaker, she is a very, very talented and passionate young woman who cares not just about the politics of what she does, but for the people in her care as a result of her ministerial portfolio. She is, I must tell you, Mr. Speaker, the unsung hero of the building of South Wickham House and she must be loved for the elderly. She has been administered with responsibility for social services and the disabled and responsibility for housing, but also has ensured that those developments are prepared for people with disabilities and the elderly in a way that works for them. She has done extraordinary work in the removal works required of Albert Heath House and Bishop Cunningham House, and therefore creating a new ministry today within the concept of a housing ministry is that of the Ministry of Affordable Housing. No longer will the government deal through its housing ministry just with the rental of government property. We will now also deal with, through the housing ministry, with the development of affordable property, something which has traditionally been done through under 6 common tariffs alone. In the post-Brexit scenario that we face, it is important that I be able to continue to do the international work which I now have to deal with the Deputy Chief Minister, but that should not delay the development of affordable housing in Gibraltar. And given the work that the Minister has already done in property development for the government at South Wickham House and at Newmarket Lodge, and the deep understanding that she has, therefore, of building requirements, I think it is absolutely right and proper that she should be given the additional responsibility of taking on support for affordable housing schemes and the responsibility and obligation that we acquired at the last general election to develop approximately 1,500 more affordable homes in the lifetime of this parliament. Work is quite advanced on paper and respectively. The time now has come to start the process of delivering them, and I'm going to ask her to start and lead in that process herself. The Minister has also done some fantastic work in the area of collection of housing arrears, as many members of the House will know, and actually what she's doing at housing is to continue that responsibility, as well as the responsibility for equality and the minority, which will come groundbreaking work in the past 5 years. She's also changed dramatically under the auspices of her role as Minister for Equality and the way that we deal with minorities and how we approach equality, and it is right that we should continue to have that responsibility. Samantha also takes on responsibilities of civic rights, citizens' advice and the ombudsman, consumer affairs and protection, data protection and health and safety, and with a heavy heart, Mr. Speaker, I must also announce that she will take on responsibility for the control of drugs and abuses in substance abuse and responsibility for abuse of funds. The reason I say once again with a heavy heart is because you will know that I wanted to take on that responsibility myself after the last general election. I'm very keen to see a lot of work in that area, but it is impossible for me to do that work at the moment, given the work I have to do internationally in respect to Brexit. Therefore, I've asked Samantha to take on that responsibility. I know that she will do it well, and what I propose to do is to create an interministerial committee on the prevention and misuse of drugs and on rehabilitation of drug offenders, which I will chair, and which will include Samantha and also the Minister for Justice and Health, Neil Costner. So that I can do some of the work that I want to do, although I do not feel the important work that needs to be done more efficiently in respect to that particular area of that of responsibility. We see that Stephen and others will continue to be Minister for Culture, Youth and Sport, but he will relinquish responsibility for heritage, which, as I told you, will become the responsibility of Dental Trust. Stephen has done an absolutely excellent job in respect to the work he's done in sport and culture. It's in his time that we've seen the development of event-led tourism as a result of the events that are organised by the Ministry of Culture, in particular the Gibraltar Music Festival, which I think is something that will now continue to grow and grow. And in the context of the work that he has already done, this fantastic political operator who is vivacious and convivial, and all who know get on with, will also assist me by taking on responsibility for broadcasting and the media, which until now has been my own responsibility, and I also would like to be relinquished in order to be better able to deal with the international issues facing the world today. Paul Aldana is a serious operator who knows his areas of responsibility better than absolutely anyone in Gibraltar or in the economy, and I'm going to ask him to head a new department, which will be a Department for Infrastructure and Planning, bringing together all the areas of technical services, town planning and transport, and public service vehicles and public transport, together with his existing responsibilities for traffic, parking, roads and licensing and vehicles, and of course the implementation of the Sustainable Traffic and Transport Plan. That is best described in our view, not just as the Department of Technical Services, but a Department of Infrastructure and Planning, which is really what it is, and I'm confident that we are now very close indeed to being able to make major announcements in respect of the implementation of the strategic traffic and price of time. And last, and most certainly not least, Mr. Speaker, of course, is the man that David and I are lucky to have as a political mentor within the government, the former Chief Minister of the Honourable David Sammer, another one of the young and talented people in my government, who will remain Minister for Economic Development and Inward Investment, and will continue to have responsibility for international trade and telecommunications and enterprise, but who will see the creation of a new ministry today, which I'm asking him to head, which is a Ministry of Public Sector Efficiency. I think it is essential, in the context of the world into which we are going to be operating, that we understand that the public sector that we fund is as efficient as it can be. We don't believe in austerity and we don't believe in cuts, in particular, and we are and remain committed to the many levels of the civil service. But we do believe in efficiency, and I think that one of the biggest selling points of the world is to be one of the most efficient places in the world in which we can do business. In order to do that, we have to keep constantly under review how our public sector works and what it delivers to the community that we need to be bound to serve. As Chief Minister of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, my first obligation is to serve the public in Gibraltar, and I have what is in fact the public sector. Each of my ministries has a responsibility to taxpayers and to voters. Every single civil servant, everybody who takes their emoluments from the Crown, has a responsibility to the public to be the most efficient in the way that we discharge our obligations to them. And it is absolutely right, therefore, that we constantly check and review how we do public sector efficiencies in Gibraltar to ensure that we get the best results that we can and that we are dealing with inward investors and we are dealing with those who want to do business in Gibraltar in the most efficient way. And, Mr. Speaker, I think that creating the responsibility for public sector efficiency through David Sammer, who understands the public sector intimately, having been Chief Minister and having been a leading trade unionist in the 1970s and 80s, will work very well with him retaining responsibility for the civil service and other people taking responsibility for commerce. In that way, together, we can work to calibrate how best to ensure that the public sector delivers to this community as efficiently as it should. I'm also asking David Sammer to take on responsibility for meter procurement, because this is one of the areas where I believe that the public sector can do better. I have believed that passionately since we were elected. I believe that we've done a lot of work already with the excellent people in the Department for Procurement to make our procurement better, but I think we can improve it even more. And finally, Mr. Speaker, there will also be taking responsibility for training and for the Gibraltar Saving Plan. Mr. Speaker, as I think is obvious, this is a government of a huge Gibraltarian talent. We don't do everything right, but we try to do as much as we can, as well as we can. And with this discussion, I believe that we can go further in doing so. I believe that these new departments will make for a better layout of ministries, which are better suited to deliver our strongest foundations and investors, and to deal with the many challenges that Brexit presents to us. It may be necessary to tinker a little more around the areas of this discussion in the future, because we are creating new departments, but we need to make sure that everything is picked up in the right effect in the right places, as some of these departmental changes take effect. But I'm sure that with the energy and the enthusiasm and the vigour that my ministers will bring to the work that they will continue to do now in their new ministries, we will be able to produce excellent results again, not just for the DSOP Liberals at the next election, but for the whole of the Gibraltar in the delivery of the service that we provide as a government, and that is what matters the most. And in reshuffling and in rebooting and in refreshing this government, I am conscious that it is important for us always for the political philosophy that we hold to ensure that no one on this side of the House ever feels that we have become the establishment. We are not, Mr. Speaker. We are the representatives of the electorate in the heart of government, and with this reshuffle, I hope we will be able to do more for those that we serve. In this month, Mr. Speaker, I hope that ministers with new responsibilities will be able to as well with members opposite in respect of the discharge of our respective parliamentary responsibilities also. Thank you very much.
May I explain for the benefit of the new members, the relatively new members now, that it is effective when a ministerial statement is made in Parliament to allow members of the opposition to ask questions for clarification if they so wish.
We now move on to answers to all questions.
Can I clear up a couple of things in here? I take it that the answers to the questions that have already been submitted will continue to be made by the outgoing ministers as well.
figure, yes, it's a little bit more to say in the course of my statement, but for this parliamentary session, members will be answering questions in respect of the ministries in which they were at the time the questions were submitted.
For the next meeting of Parliament, there is a need for the clerk and for the chief minister to consider the actual titles in respect of each new title, in respect of each minister that are going to be inserted in the answers, so that they are explanatory, but not longer than is absolutely necessary. So that is something that can be carried out between now and then.
Okay, yes. I don't think the time has changed very much, and in fact, they're probably now shorter. Yes, I think they're probably shorter now than they were. Legal notice 2016, which has been issued, I understand, a few moments ago, is the notice under Section 46.1 of the Constitution signed by the Deputy of the particular direction under Section 46, which actually provides the new titles. And I'm sure if one of them seems a little wrong, the clerk and I from the IA to agree a suitably abridged version for reading purposes.
We now commence with question number 609. The questioner is the Honourable Ms. M.D. Hassan Naim.
Mr. Speaker, if I may I echo my congratulations to the Leader of the Opposition and Tolkien Silk. I'm very happy for him to have received this honour. And also, if I may, I would like to take this opportunity also to wish all 10 ministers the best of luck in their respective new portfolios, that they will run and deliver their new mandate with distinction and to the best of their ability for the betterment of our community. Mr. Speaker, I know I have said this before, but even though we may not share the same political vision, I want to thank in particular Minister Cortez for always having his door open in the Health Ministry. It's amazing how many people he has helped me to help, and I thank him for his approachability. I similarly look forward to sharing positive working relationships with the other ministers in their new portfolios for the good of our people. Now, moving on to my question. Can the Minister of Education explain whether he is satisfied with the placing of graduates in jobs which reflect their speciality once they return from the UK?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, the information request is not available, and very few graduates return to the board to register with the Employment Service as unemployed, and therefore submit to the Employment Service their qualifications, including the degree they have read. Whereas it is, of course, wonderful to be able to report to the House that most graduates find direct employment as a result of a thriving economy, it means, unfortunately, they do not have any empirical basis on which I can provide an answer to the Honourable Lady's specific question. When terms of engagement are received by the Employment Service, their qualifications, including their degree, are not submitted, as it is not a legal requirement under the Employment Regulations 1994. I can tell the Honourable Lady, however, that whereas the 2012 Census Report does not provide specific details on whether a graduate's job reflects his or her speciality, the data shows that most graduates are employed in professional, managers and senior officials, and associate professional and technical occupations. In fact, 84% of male and female graduates in full-time employment were registered in these occupations.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to ask the Honourable Member, Minister Costa. I have spoken with various individuals who come back from the UK and spent a few years in Gibraltar, feeling a little lost because they haven't been able to put their speciality to the best of their ability. I appreciate the statistics that the Honourable Member has put out. But what would there be a policy to help such people who are feeling that their specialities are a little wasted and not used? Where would they turn, and what would you recommend that they do in order for them to feel that they are managing or satisfying that speciality?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I remind the Honourable Lady that at some point this year the Honourable
former Minister for Education, Mr. Lukubi, and I announced the creation of an employment development service so that there are officials within the employment service, that being specifically with graduates returning from Gibraltar, and they guide and assist and advise them on vacancies that are available within the private sector, and of course any public vacancies, any vacancies coming up in the public sector. As I've explained to the Honourable Lady, it is thankfully in fact that most graduates are in turn, our family sector is very interesting, and all the good ones are taking up in industry, and those that are having some trouble, whether they can send the employment service and even the education service, are to be able to be guided. I have met with various, I think off the top of my head, maybe 4 or 5, graduates and trainees who've had some difficulty in finding employment based on the specialty that they've got. But I'm happy to say that most of them have been able to find a job that is tangentially at least related to that academic qualification.
So if I may, one last time, what about the situation where perhaps a graduate has been here for many years and perhaps he's been working somewhere else but has a different speciality that he or she hasn't wanted to take up then? Does that individual become sort of expired to the system that you are now explaining to us works? Is it only for recent graduates, or can you understand what I'm getting at? Thank you.
I think I understand the Honourable Lady's question. The services provided by the Employment Service is open to absolutely every graduate, whether they've just returned from the UK or whether they've worked in the United Kingdom or elsewhere and are returning. It's a new service. It's relatively recent. It was only announced and came into operation, if I recall correctly, just before summer. So maybe I have been guilty of not making sufficient announcements or sufficient communications on the existence of the service. And whether they're not no longer the Minister for Employment, I know that the current Minister for Employment would be equally delighted to meet here in person, if we have certain people in mind that we may be able to assist. Mr. Speaker, a related supplementary. What about incentivizing young people to do degrees in areas and professional qualifications in areas which are going to be necessary for the economy in the future? And is that something the government is also considering and has considered?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. In fact, the reason why I didn't address the point asked in the supplementary question is because the Honourable Lady was asking me about returning graduates. But the employment service, career service that I spoke of just recently, also deals with the Department of Education, and jointly they present public talk and also they host private meetings and tutorials with the education department attending the school, and they identify what are the industries in which the daughter are bound to visit in the future. I know that Minister Bassanov, when he was the Minister for Employment, made rightly the case that there were vacancies coming in respect of accounting and auditing. And to his credit, to the Honourable Gentleman's credit, I think we have over 60 graduates currently, as a result of Minister Bassanov's efforts, currently undergoing accounting and finance in the UK for over the 3 years. Accounting and auditing firms we find they will no longer keep vacancy elsewhere, but rather will be able to recruit home talent. The education department and employment together, of course, work also closely with Mr. Ricola, who assists in feeding information such as gaming and financial services. So we think that collectively and holistically we've been able to, I think the Honourable Gentleman has done, identify a gap where we should be telling students before they go to university and before they choose their careers which are the opportunities that are likely to arise when they intend to go there.
I'm very grateful for that, and indeed the accountancy has been a long-standing issue. Not only during the current for this government, but going back to the GOD government, and there's been a huge amount of recruiting of accountants from the Philippines, of all places. I don't know why the Philippines, but it has been
but it's been a lot of recruitment from the Philippines, as well, but there's been a lesson from across the country. But is the government's philosophy and policy limited to information? In other words, providing students with the information of the vacancies of the areas that might be growth areas in the future, or is the government going further and providing incentives to students to go into those areas? I mean, off the top of my head, well, something that that we certainly put in our manifesto will top up grants, for example, in relation to students going to the United Kingdom and doing certain kinds of degrees which are necessary in order to first build that feelings of growth in areas that it might be necessary.
Question number 610, the Honourable T.M. Hume. Additional support to encourage people to go in the right in that area. And unfortunately, there have been no takers, even though we've got 950 people in. So, you know, I think historically, when the GSRT took on the commitment to provide everybody with the opportunity of going into higher education, the philosophy has been, since then, to give every child that comes out of school the opportunity to do what is their natural inclination and what they are likely to be best at, without, in fact, focusing on whether it would be what the Bolton needed. And to that extent, the old practice of saying if people didn't come back to work in Gibraltar, they would be penalized, didn't stop making any sense because we were not asking them to go and study for something specifically. But I think there may be a time in the future where we'll need to revisit that. It hasn't happened so far. But the incentive in the particular area of telecommunications where I'm involved has not worked.
Question number 610, the Honourable Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, can government say what should be the total cost of the Wellington Front refurbishment, and if any of that cost is falling outside of the contract with Koala Limited, and if so, what that amount is and to whom it has been paid?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sports, Culture.
Mr. Speaker, we're not in a position at this moment in time to provide the information requested, but I expect to be able to do so when the project completes. Mr. Speaker, I understand there may not be a precise figure in the final cost, but can the Minister not provide some information on the cost to date and whether any of those costs have fallen outside of the contract with Koala, or can it even indicate whether any costs whatsoever have fallen outside of the contract with Koala? Mr. Speaker, the project is not yet finished, but there was a contract with Koala, as the Honourable Member rightly says. Yes, there might have been a certain amount of work, but what we always try to do in these cases is that if we have a budget for the project, we might then at the end say that, okay, you do this job, but don't do that job, which is part of the specification, and therefore, in order to keep within the budget. And that's why it's very difficult at this moment in time to give the Honourable Member how all the invoices that come for different work that have happened there, and if anybody going through Wellington Front, you will see that different jobs have been coming, cropping up within the general project. So, like I said, what we do is we try and see how we can cut down on certain things that were originally there, or probably not necessary,
in order to try and cover up for work that might be necessary. I think I understand what the Honourable Gentleman is saying, and I just try and paraphrase and I ask myself to mention what do you say means, and it is my medium in a construction concept. What do you say means? The main concept went to Koala, but in order to keep costs down, certain aspects of the job were subcontracted to some other construction company or some other company because they were able to do it cheaper than Koala. No? Well, could you explain, Peter? Therefore, I haven't understood it. It has nothing to do with the work being cheaper. The contract was given to Koala. So the Koala then subcontract in the general contract is up to Koala who they subcontract the different work. What I am saying is that in the general project of the whole of the Wellington Front, there are certain things that nothing to do with cheap or not cheap. It's what you want done or not want done. Nothing to do with the price. But I'll give you an example. The outside walls of which are in Queensbury, for example, were originally to be plastered, to be put, blasted and everything like that. And you thought, well, that is not really necessary to do because the project and the walls are all right as they are now. But the money you were going to spend to do that, to do something else inside, which we would like you to do. And whether it be Koala does it through another subcontracting of the Koala to decide who does their work for them. That's what I mean. Okay, Mr. Peter, so essentially what he is saying is that there are no costs that have fallen outside the contract with Koala because there is a government contract with Koala, and whether Koala subcontracts to anybody else is up to Koala. That's what he's saying. Correct? Therefore, the answer to the question is by my honourable friend is there are no costs that are falling outside the contract with Koala.
No, Mr. Speaker. The answer to the question is the answer first given, that the project is not yet finished and that it may be that there are some costs which will wait for the project, or maybe there are not. But when the project is finished, we'll be able to tell them. The only gentleman should know that we're in front of an area which has, for example, bridge pipes going through it and bridge pumps going in it. Now, some of those are assigned to this project, some are not. We want to give an answer which is correct. We have to wait for the project to finish in order to be able to give an answer which is correct. Because the last thing we want to do is to give an answer which is not correct. By the way, we are accused of giving inaccurate information to the House, the other members do not want to be receiving. In the case of a project like this, when it is finished, we will be able to give a detailed breakdown of the cost.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, but I understand that explanation that one of the witnesses provided is applicable to the cost of the project. Because what he's saying is, well, look, we can't provide you with the cost of the project because we're still receiving invoices, and until we basically collect all these invoices and look at them, we can't provide you with information. But part of the question is different. Part of the question is whether there have been any costs that have fallen outside the contract with Koala. And I would have thought, I'm not going to put this, but I would have thought that is something that the government is capable of answering. Because either, and you see, he has provided two different answers. Either everything has been included in the contract with Koala, with Koala and subcontracts, or there is a contract with Koala, and there are several minor or larger, I don't know, contracts with third parties. And that's the question, whether it's the former or the latter.
Well, Peter, I just don't understand what the Honourable Gentleman thinks he's saying. Look, there is a contract with Koala, which is obviously being honoured, and the works are being done. And if in the context of that contract, Koala subcontracts anything, it's a matter entirely for Koala. We would get the invoice from Koala, and we finish the project, we'd be able to tell them that that project is cost effective. But there may be other things happening in the case of Wellington Front. But the question is about Wellington Front. Yes, of course we know. But they relate to the project and the wider aspects of the project. Some of them may be in the original determination of what the project should be, I thought it would be outside the original determination of the process to do, because it's normally a general gentleman in the construction process that you may end up breaking something off to work, or something may turn out not to be of the standard and quality that you expected when you were going into a project. It may break and it has to be repaired. Now, that would be known at the end of the project. The noble gentleman who's been in government and has been in charge of process areas, so hesitates to remind him. So he hesitates to remind him of how overspent his projects were and how overspent his government even was. I mean, at the airport, they went from $24 million to $84 million, the highest overspend in the history of the global politics. Probably one of the highest overspend in the history of politics in the world, Mr. Speaker. But in respect of this project at Wellington Trump, we will be able to give a full and accurate answer when the project is finished.
Mr. Speaker, it certainly wasn't my intention when I forwarded the question. I didn't expect quite a convoluted and different. It wasn't my intention to catch government out in any way. It was a genuine interest to find out whether there was anything beyond the scope. Because I'm aware that government do publish some figures. I don't know the running total of work related to Wellington Front being carried out by Koala. And I was interested to know whether any other works may be factored in, which aren't available under the government website. If I were to come back at the next session and rephrase the question for a rather new total cost, these running tests so far, does the government think it would be able to provide an answer as to costs accrued so far, both to this Koala and potentially to any other company that may be involved?
Mr. Speaker, with most of the projects, invoicing is happening all the time. There are adjustments happening, and we don't know if the information is going to end up next to be accurate, because when we give information in good faith, which is then subject to adjustments, then we're exposing ourselves to suggestions that we've somehow misled the house either intentionally or unintentionally. So I would rather wait for a moment when we're able to give accurate information and not give a management account of any particular project. That's the number of it, because we don't think that that is in the interest of efficiency.
Mr. Speaker, this sort of was presumably go out to tender. So the government obviously has a price in this particular contract. Are they prepared to at least say whether the price, whether the job is within the price, or is it going to exceed the price? What is the price?
Mr. Speaker, again, I think Honourable Gentleman has heard me say before that where a contract is not completed, we don't want to disclose that information because it's not in the government's commercial interest to do so. We're still at every stage, like every developer, negotiating the context of what is being delivered and trying to get the best deal for the taxpayer. As is in the course of every potential development, things are coming up which we might think are new and not in the original scope, but which we want done in the original price, and that is an ongoing negotiation. So at the end of the process, we will be able to tell the noble gentleman what the job given was, what the tender price was, what the final price was, and what the variations were. And I think that is within the best interest of the taxpayer, so that we provide the community with full transparency as to the contract and the tender price, the actual completion value of the contract, and what was done for that completion value.
Can the government therefore confirm, because I'm in some doubt now, I wasn't previously, but I'm actually in some doubt, with respect to the figure that publishes on its website related to this project on payments made to Koala, that those figures it publishes are accurate, because it seems government isn't absolutely certain whether it can provide the council with information that is accurate? Been of course they're accurate because it's a reflection of payments made. So they're accurate as to a transaction. In other words, this is the amount that has been paid. Now, what has it been paid for? Some of it is advance payment in respect of some aspects of the work, some of it is money before retained in respect of other aspects of the work where the period of the retention is now at an end. So it's an accurate reflection, a snapshot of what has been paid. But in terms of what it's been paid for, there's obviously constant in any project, large or small, a constant negotiation between the government and the providing services here, which comes to an end in a final account, and that is when we can give accurate information as to payments made and what for. in which case in Sofia, because I can find information on payments made to Koala, but not to any other companies related to the Wellington Trent project, would it be correct to say that no payments have thus far been made to any third parties directly by government, any other companies directly by government with respect to the Wellington Trent project?
So in the CP of the Honourable Gentleman takes the term Wellington Trent project to mean that which Koala was contracted to do and is defined in that way. Because it may be that you've got, and I'm literally inventing this for the purpose of illustration, you could have a company that deals with sewage that has been asked to do sewage clearing work, and that would be using the complete field of the for infrastructure and planning to use the terminology I'll use in the next week of that, and that may also relate to work done in the context of Wellington Front. Now, that's not the Wellington Front project, but it's at Wellington Front, and it may have been brought to our attention as a result of the Wellington Front project, and an expansive definition of the Wellington Front project might include that, because Koala might have told us that they can't get new pipes in until the sewage is installed. And that's why it is accurate to say that payments in respect of that project have already been made to Koala and not to third parties, but that there may be third parties being paid for work that somehow tangentially also relates to Wellington Front more generally, but which may have an effect on Wellington Front is also too.
Question number 611, the Honourable R.M. Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, how much does the government estimate the construction of a national theatre would cost?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, we're not in a position at this moment in time to disclose information requested. Various estimates of what the theatre will cost are available to government. The project has not yet commenced, and when it does, in order to get the best deal for the voter, it would be unwise to disclose what we think each option should cost.
Mr. Speaker, I have the Honourable Minister for his answer. I wanted to give the ballpark where it's going to be somewhere between 10 or 20 million or a million or 500,000 or any idea at all. I know still part of a ride or understanding is we could confirm the location would still be the site of the old Queen's Dinner and the Queen's Hotel, which I think the government bought for about £5 million.
Mr. Speaker, we won't be giving an estimate of a ballpark within the US first of all, because that is still a hypothetical question which is not allowed under the rules of the law. And second, Mr. Speaker, because it would be foolish and extreme for us to do so. And if we pitch it here in the House just for the purposes of entertaining the Honourable Gentleman with a ballpark claim, we may be pitching it higher than it should be. And some of you might be able to do it, so yes, for this community, might then take the advantage of saying, well, if they think it's ballpark X, I'm going to go up to X, and I'm going to be in their ballpark. So, given that we are very prudent in terms of looking after the public trust, and we look after every single thing, I can assure him, Mr. Speaker, that we're not going to do anything that puts us at risk of giving an advantage to those who commercially interface with the government by falling into the trap of answering his hypothetical question. But I can tell him this, we have absolutely no intention of wasting £10 million in the process of preparing for the development.
Mr. Speaker, possibly the Honourable Chief Minister later on for my second question, what is the third pipe still between the cinema or the King's Hotel?
Question number 6.
And Mr. Speaker, in relation to this particular project, is this a project that the government intends to complete in the next 4 years?
I know that the Honourable Gentleman chivvies between asking us please not to complete our manifesto because it costs too much and he thinks we can't afford it, and then chastising us for not completing those parts of our manifesto that we identified we haven't yet done, and suggesting that we should have done so. I have absolutely no intention of falling into the invitation spelled T-R-A-P of not completing our manifesto in the lifetime of the silence, given this is a manifesto meeting.
Question number 612, the Honourable Ian Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise current employment to address the concerns of the health and success in respect of citing the proposed external lift to Parliament, and why is the chair lift not a viable alternative option?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar is fully committed to an inclusive society where nobody is disadvantaged. We aim to provide such an inclusive environment in all our public buildings, regardless of age, gender, or disability. To do so, we have to consider removing barriers which have been imposed in the past. We have to acknowledge that buildings were designed without considering those disabilities. We all therefore face a time when such inclusiveness is to be achieved in historic buildings. We have to balance the safeguarding of our historic fabric with its continued use by all members of our society. The government continues to consider all options. We acknowledge and we are grateful to the Heritage Trust who have voiced their concerns. However, we are committed in providing access to all and feel that we have left no stone unturned when looking for possible solutions. We do continue to look forward in working with the Trust in all our projects. The question on the use of a chairlift is an option which was discarded by technical experts advising government, as it raises a number of obvious issues. While chairlifts may be acceptable in a private dwelling where their use is restricted to a few individuals with limited mobility, their use in public buildings, such as this Parliament, raises a number of concerns. Apart from the fact that the public serves as a fire escape and restricting its already narrow width imposes significant risks, there are more basic issues such as how someone with this disability is to be managed. Where are the wheelchairs to be stored? Those who are disabled are to be treated with dignity, and they deserve, and we do not believe that a chairlift is the best option.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Mr. Honourable Member. Unfortunately, I don't believe I've had an answer to the question in terms of the concerns of the House, if he's made that red letter to him or to the government. They were concerned that they had originally agreed to the fighting of a lift at the north-east corner of the building, and now to be on the north-west corner of the building, in which is, I think, a slightly different geometric design to the, I think, the original option one, as opposed to the third option three. Can the Minister please explain why, what was previously agreed with the government, the government now changed its mind?
Mr. Speaker, because having the lift in the northeast corner of Main Street side provided with a ramp, and the ramp would have come through at a gradient of 1.3, assuming headroom, right, is at 2.3, which is the norm. And therefore, we or 1.6, assuming that the headroom is 2 meters, which is less. And therefore, it falls short of the limit that is legal, which is 1.12. And therefore, to put a gradient at the angle of where the lift would have actually come to and then get into this chamber would have been too much of a gradient, and therefore it would have been made it illegal. So the technical advice that we've had is that doing it on the northeast of this building, although I must say that the principle of putting a lift outside has already been accepted, it is a question of whether we put it on the northeast or on the northwest. And it is obviously technically easier and legal to put it on the northwest, which was the original place where it was agreed. But then, yes, I mean, with consultation with the Heritage Trust and my office, the Ministry of Heritage, together came and thought that it would be better to do it on the northeast. And when all the technical work came about doing it in the northeast, all these things arose about the gradient. So there was no other option but to go back to where it was originally, which was the Heritage Trust was not quite happy with, but neither were the Heritage Ministry, but there is no other option. And therefore, it is decided that it should be on the northwest of the building. But the enclosure of the building is the same. It's exactly the same. It's either you put the lift on the northeast or the northwest. So it was thought at the time, because I was involved in that it looks better for the building rather than the northeast. But these things have arisen, which are of a technical nature, of a legal nature, and therefore we have to revert to going to the northwest. And I'm pointing because in the hall, this is exactly where we would do the lift.
This seems to help us to speak, and I would get really pleased to hear. But with all of those issues have now landed on my desk, and I am not satisfied that it is not possible to pursue other options, and I am looking at those other options myself. But I will say with equal clarity that if the choice comes when it is only possible to do it in one particular way, then it will be done in that way, whether or not we would all wish it to be done in another. It is the most important of the two principles that we are dealing with, and both of them are hugely important. First, the preservation of our heritage, and second, access to people with disabilities. The second one is the one that is most important. So we are going to continue to try again to get this right in a way that satisfies not just the heritage staff, everyone in the world who is concerned about heritage. I mean, they happen to have the opportunity to voice their concerns and support, but in the ministry in particular, and in my office, we have these concerns as well, and we want to get it absolutely right. But when you put in the end on the balance, which I hope we don't have to do, doing it one way which does not satisfy the Ministry of Heritage and the Heritage Trust or even us, but is the only way to guarantee access to disabled people, then the hammer will fall in favour of disabled people in the country.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for Chief Minister's intervention. I'm glad to hear that his office is having a look at the whole issue. I, of course, agree entirely with him. Access is the main priority, and certainly we need to bear that in mind. Obviously, this building is not designed in a time when there's a time of city. But I agree with him. I don't know that disability access must come first. It may be a complete diversion, but I notice the provisional effects provision for members of the staff. Maybe that will come at a later date, or maybe it will come on in parallel. But that, I would simply recall the common objection to members of the public passing through the chamber in a bit of a fight in that side of the house, rather than that side of the house. But anyway, it's a by the by, and obviously I certainly would not want to incur the cost of it, but a double the cost of that. This very conceptual list just for our convenience. But the Honourable Minister on Heritage mentioned the question of legal matters. And just for the benefit of members who may or may not be aware, under the Gibraltar Heritage Act, this building is actually listed on the Schedule 2 as a Class 3B listed building under Section 40, which means there is a restriction under Section 49. And that description means that needs to give me what I read for my not so big firm, it comes up somewhere, yeah? No person who wanted to instantly list a B building, blocks your cycle around shall I only play part A, which is well in part B is about trees or fairly generally building, but probably not in this case. Make to that building sacrifice land any alterations, addition, repair, or effective archaeological, or architectural, artistic, historical, or vernacular character. Except, in accordance with a permit in writing, if it's not part of the service, by the government's sanction after consultation with the board being, of course, the Board of Heritage Trust. So I think what I'm trying to say is the Board of Heritage Trust is more than just an NGO acting in this case, it actually has a legal standing in whether or not the permit is issued, and obviously don't have that in consultation with it. But if I read the letter from the Heritage Trust to the government, I notice they make reference to the heritage permit. I wonder if that permit was for the northeast corner or for the northwest corner, and is that permit going to be changed? And Mr. Speaker, let me start by dealing with the first point that the Honourable Gentleman does. We have absolutely no intention whatsoever of installing a list for Honourable Members to be able to access this place. Honourable Members are advised to take the chair. It's good for all of us, Mr. Speaker. If there is a member who is disabled, that is why we are going to add a list so that he can come and access this place to himself, or he can come and watch this place in action if he's not a member. But there will be one list, Mr. Speaker. And I think that is absolutely sufficient for honourable members or members of the public. And Mr. Speaker, frankly, if we need to close our stairs and we need to come in through the general area, well, we could. You know, members of the House of Commons access the House of Commons through the same door that members of the public access the House of Commons. They sometimes have advantages in terms of security in areas that they can access, and people will not be able to access the back. But we have absolutely zero intention of doubling up the cost in respect of access to the children in the country as in a list. And second, Mr. Speaker, the law provides that the permit is required. No permit has been issued, Mr. Speaker. There is consultation in the process of making a final determination. That consultation with the Heritage Trust is entitled to under the Act has already occurred, but the government nonetheless now is taking other considerations into account in order to be able to try and marry those competing concerns of protecting our heritage and giving access to people with disabilities, which, by the way, is something that we have been wrestling with for some time now, but was never the policy of the previous administration. Never the policy of the previous administration. Something which I think is fundamental, and we will get this right, and we'll get it right for the protection of our heritage and for access to people with disabilities. Mr. Speaker, can I now move that the House will now adjourn to tomorrow at 2:30 in the afternoon?
The House will now adjourn to tomorrow, 2:30 in the afternoon, when we will proceed with the 613.